Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast, brought to you by the Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory at the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences. It is our goal to advance the understanding of honeybees and beekeeping, grow the beekeeping community, and improve the health of honeybees everywhere. In this podcast, you'll hear research updates, beekeeping management practices discussed, and advice on beekeeping from our resident experts, beekeepers, scientists, and other program guests. Join us for today's program, and thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast. Welcome to Two Bees in a Podcast. In today's episode, we will be interviewing Dr. Judy Wu Smart from the University of Nebraska. She will be talking to us about some of the pesticide research that she does. She looks a lot at pesticides and their impacts on bees, and so we'll have a great discussion with her about that. We will follow that discussion by having an in-depth review of risks associated with pesticide exposure. Amy and I will be talking quite a bit about that. Of course, we will conclude our podcast today with questions from our readers and our attempt to answer those questions. So thanks for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast. Hello, everyone. I think we have a really good segment here for you. We are going to be interviewing Dr. Judy Wu Smart. Judy is an assistant professor and extension specialist in the Department of Entomology at the University of Nebraska Lincoln Bee Lab, where she's been working for 4 years. Dr. Wu Smart, thank you for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Hey, we're totally excited. I'm joined by Amy. Amy, are you as excited as I am?
I am excited. We get to talk about pesticides today, everyone's favorite topic.
Yeah, I don't know why you're excited about that, because pesticides are obviously a hot button issue. So I'm going to introduce a little bit, Judy, if I might, and then we'll start questioning you about some of the work that you've been doing and your feelings on pesticides. So this topic of pesticides is obviously a big deal. In fact, in many ways, it's both dangerous to study pesticides and dangerous to talk about pesticides, mm-hmm. because there are fanatics on both sides of the aisle, people who are uber pro pesticides, and anything you say against them, you're dead. But even more so, people who are uber against pesticides and anything you suggest that you know that they don't harm bees in certain ways, and then you're all of a sudden tagged. And so you're wanting to talk about this, and I'm looking forward to seeing where this discussion goes. So let me just start from the beginning. I mean, what could you give us an overview of the type of work you do with pesticides there at the University of Nebraska?
Yeah, so my area of interest, and particularly the research efforts, are really trying to just better understand what the roles of pesticides and their exposure causes in terms of bee health and colony production and survival. And so a lot of the research that we've been looking at has been kind of moving away from whether or not a chemical can kill, whether they're lethal, or they're getting acutely exposed, but more about the nuances of these sublethal and indirect effects. So how is it impacting their behavior? How is it impacting their ability to perform as a colony, as a social unit? And so a lot of that research is just kind of really leading to highlighting some areas where we can improve in our protections, in our regulations, in our practices.
Well, how did you get interested in studying pesticides in the first place with honeybees specifically?
I've always actually had kind of an interest in a concern for conservation and environmental protection.
Sure.
And, you know, I really didn't know much about bees growing up, but when I was working in Florida as an intern in 2007, that's when CCD happened. That's when, you know, we started learning about it in the media, and it was a really nice kind of opening of perspectives of, yes, I love environmental science, I love conservation, and bees are a perfect system to study both of, you know, something that is important for our long-term sustainability, but also for our food production, our, you know, economic production.
So Judy, can you tell us some of the impacts of the pesticides on bees, or some of the stuff that you've been finding in your lab with some of the research that you've done?
Right. So I think with the research that I'm focusing on, I'm specifically looking more at a particular type of pesticide. And I think people commonly lump pesticides all together and think that they're equally harmful or affecting bees. And really, there's insecticides, there's fungicides, there's herbicides. These things are targeting different organisms, but can also impact bees in different ways. And so I think that's important for people to understand that, you know, even if I am studying a particular class of insecticides like neonicotinoids, the impacts on bee health and the effects that we see on the colony level is really very specific to that compound, that circumstance. And there are just hundreds of active compounds that are being used and even more formulations that are being used out there. And so I think the impacts of pesticides is wide varying, and it's not just, is it killing them? Is it lethal? Is it toxic? But how are these other impacts affecting their ability to survive? So like herbicides, they target weeds, but we know that if you are removing all your unwanted weeds, you're altering the habitat and you're making the available bee forage, like dandelions and clovers, just unavailable for them. And so that is causing malnutrition, which could lead to higher susceptibility of pests and pathogens. And with fungicides, there's growing research with like their impacts on the microbiome. So again, affecting their nutrition, their ability to absorb nutrients. I think these are things that people are just starting to really focus on in terms of these colony level impacts, rather than, hey, did it hurt a bee? Did it affect one individual bee? How is it affecting the entire colony?
So Judy,
that's what my research is trying to do.
Yeah. So I think you raised so many interesting points in that dialogue. Let me just kind of, for the sake of the listeners, explain just a few things. You mentioned, for example, the different classes of pesticides. That is true. So pesticide, the word pesticide broadly means anything used to kill a pest. And insecticides are one of those groups, right? Insecticides kill insects, fungicides target fungal pathogens, and so on. Within insecticides, there are different classes. You mentioned neonicotinoids. There's also organophosphates, et cetera. And one of the things that's interesting but hard to teach beekeepers is this idea of formulation. So let's look at glyphosate as an example. Glyphosate is the active ingredient in the formulation called Roundup, but it might be formulated different ways, right? It might have different surfactants and adjuvants that are added to it to improve its efficacy in the field. So, you know, a lot of research is done on active ingredients, the pure active ingredient like glyphosate, rather than the formulation like Roundup. And the same is true really across the board with a lot of pesticides. And it's, so as a result, it's somewhat hard to predict their impact based on what we find out about them just from active ingredients, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In order for a researcher to assess the risk of a compound, we have to do all of our research with the active ingredient, that one ingredient. But that ingredient makes up a very, very small proportion of the total formulation. So like what Jamie had mentioned, the formulation could have surfactants, additives, inert ingredients. And we're starting to find that even some of these inert, you know, quote unquote, inert ingredients are causing direct harm on bees. Unfortunately, most of these formulations are patented products. So we know what the active ingredient is. We don't know what the other 90% of that compound or that formulation is. So as a researcher, it's much difficult to, I mean, if you were to try to test every single formulation out there, that would just take an entire lifetime to just test a particular class.
Yeah, and then you've got to, you know, factor in the issue that there's rarely just one compound present in a colony, right? So then there's potential interactive effects, and then how do these the presence of these compounds interact with nutritional stresses or varroa stresses or small hive beetle stresses, et cetera? So, you know, there's a lot of potential impacts of pesticides on bees. I use the word potential just because the possibility exists for an impact doesn't mean the impact's actually going to happen in the field. Right.
Right. You're absolutely right. Yep. Something that is tested in the lab, like many of our toxicity tests are done in a laboratory setting. Once you take that into the field, now you have to account for all the variables of the climate, the weather, the temperature, the other bees in the colonies. And And many of that is definitely complicates our ability to measure those impacts, especially the subtle ones.
Yeah, so I kind of have, this is probably a really stupid question, but I'm going to ask
it anyway.
All right,
we love Amy's stupid questions.
Yes, yeah, there I have a lot of them. So, I mean, when you're doing research, why wouldn't you be able to take a product and just kind of, why would you not be able to just test products, you know, one product versus another product, you know, things that people would normally use? Can you explain that?
So why test glyphosate? Why not test Roundup mm-hmm. rather than glyphosate? And again, I'm mm-hmm. just using, for the listeners out there, I'm just using Roundup because you're familiar with it. I'm not making claims here that it is killing our bee population. I'm just using that for that purpose.
We are not getting paid by.
No, despite what you think.
Yeah, so I can give you an example of just more recently, the neonicotinoids. This is the newer class of insecticides that a lot of people have concerns about because mm-hmm. of their systemic action, meaning you can apply it to the plant and it can translocate to all parts. If you apply it to the seed or the soil or the water, the plant can take that up and then express those residues in the nectar and the pollen where the bees are then going to be exposed. So when we're studying neonicotinoids, this class of insecticides, there are 7 different active ingredients that could be any one of those classes. So within neonicotinoids, there's 7 different types of active ingredients. And then within those, one particular active ingredient, like imidacoprid, could have literally hundreds of formulations, hundreds of formulated products, depending on the company and depending on the brand, depending on the use. Some of these are used in homeowner situations. Some are for agricultural production. Some are commercial application only. And so each formulated product would then have to be tested for toxicity. So you can imagine that within a product itself, then you would need to vary the doses mm-hmm. of one particular formulation. So it's just endless, endless testing for, I'm not sure how much benefit that would give us.
Yeah, you know, Judy, I also do or have done a lot of pesticide research, and you know, you're talking about all the things that I had to deal with kind of mentally right early in my career. It's like, do I test formulations? Do I test actives? Do I test interactions? And it just gets complicated incredibly mm-hmm. fast in the pesticide world. And it, you know, to me, it's doubly complicated because, you know, unlike a lot of research where this is just interesting for science purposes, you know, pesticide mm-hmm. research is interesting for political purposes. So you really have to dot your I's and cross your T's and know that at some point you are going to be in someone's crosshairs, mm-hmm. right? So I want to talk to you about that. I mean, if you had issues with the press, with the public, your beekeepers, et cetera, when you present data on pesticides, have you had any issues publicly?
Oh, definitely. There's always people who want to bring you into their kind of efforts, you know, mm-hmm. whether they want to ban chemicals or they want to argue that they are not causing harm. People are always trying to rally you to their side. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm presenting the research, I try to do a lot to just explain, this is the scenario that we tested, and this is what we found, and where do we need to go from there? So try to add in the conversations, not just reporting the research and the data and showing, yeah, it causes harm, trying to tease out what it means to the big picture. So for example, I've been studying neonicotinoids and the impacts on queen egg-laying behavior, and how that's affecting honeybees and bumblebees alike. But the messaging that I kind of bring to beekeepers is a larger one that's more related to something they can do about it. So my research is narrowly focused on neonics, but even if we banned all the neonics, there would still be problems with other compounds and the ability to monitor how they're being exposed and how the bees are being impacted. So putting efforts into banning one class is really not going to solve anything. What we need to do is make changes in the policy and the monitoring efforts. Because right now, everything is focused on lethality. Does it kill? Are bees getting killed? Is a colony getting outright killed? So bee kills really kind of follow the older classes of chemicals where you saw bees just spilling out, dying outside the hive. We don't see that classical bee kill as much anymore. What we're seeing are what I call bee incidences. So these are exposure events that might have caused a minor die-off or a minor issue with a colony that can then subsequently shift the colony functions in a hive that makes them more susceptible to disease or reduces their likelihood of overwintering. So like, for example, contaminated pollen. This is one that I'm really interested in looking into research more, because bees foraging for pollen will bring it into the hive. They're not consuming them. They're putting it on their legs and they're bringing it back in. So that is a potential food source that could be heavily laden with chemicals and be brought back to the hive. If honey was highly contaminated with pesticides, the bees still have to consume that. And if it was highly laden with chemicals, the likelihood of them returning to the hive is much lower. So this pollen is a really interesting exposure route, because we know that in a social colony like honeybees, only a small proportion of those bees are consuming that pollen. And those bees are your nurse bees. Those are the bees that are going to take care of the brood. So if you can imagine foragers bringing in contaminated pollen, and if that pollen is disproportionately affecting the nurse bees in the hive, the beekeepers may miss that. But the end result is 4 weeks later, when you have natural die-off of your foragers, your naturally aged bees, you don't have young bees to replace those. The beekeeper sees this dwindling population, this either stagnant growth or dwindling of the adult worker force, and they can't tie that back to the exposure. So we're trying to work with beekeepers on how to identify an exposure incident and how to mitigate that. So if you see nurse bees dying outside your hive, you shouldn't see fuzzy nurse bees. You can replace a frame or, you know, replace the nurse bees that were lost to kind of mitigate some of that impact, that further impact on the colony.
Yeah, so Judy, can you talk to us about ways that beekeepers can mitigate those pesticide issues? So, you know, what would you recommend, or what are you teaching beekeepers?
Well, the first step is identifying when you have an incident, and that was the biggest problem, right? We have such a complicated system where colonies are put in a landscape where they may be exposed to a cocktail of chemicals at any time in the season, and beekeepers have no idea when bees are actually being exposed. So we've been recommending, and part of our research is developing dead bee traps as a monitoring tool for abnormal losses of workers.
Sure.
So not looking for acute kills, but this is just an easy setup that puts a light colored platform in front of the entrance to capture dead bees falling out of the hive. Then I've been teaching beekeepers to pick those dead bees up and identify what age group they think those bees are, because you can easily tell the difference between a very young, fuzzy, light-colored bee from an old, tattered forager.
Sure.
And if they see that there are lots of young nurse bees coming out, or deformed wing, or ejected larvae, or any of those hygienic behavior signs, then the beekeeper has an indication that they should do a more thorough inspection of their hive than just a quick check. If I see a loss of nurse bees in my hive, I might replace those nurse bees with, from a healthy colony, so that they can continue to rear their brood without, you know, that dwindling effect. So that's what I've been trying to teach beekeepers, is how do we monitor for incidences, not bee kills, but incidences. Because really, I mean, where are we going with bee kill investigations? Where does that go? It doesn't do anything for beekeepers, researchers, or policymakers.
Yeah, so just kind of taking a step back, when you were talking earlier about policymakers, can you talk to us about what researchers, beekeepers are trying to mitigate the pesticide issues? But what are all these stakeholders doing about, you know, the concerns with pesticides and bees? And then what would you recommend that they could do better?
Yeah, so I mean, researchers are doing their very best, doing the residue studies, the toxicity studies, all of the kind of background information to figure out the harm and the environmental exposure of these compounds. The farmers that are aware of these issues are applying compounds according to the label. So they're following labels. And many of the ones that we are talking about are very concerned about bee health and their impact and their role on this. So they are doing their best to follow those pesticide labels. I think what's happening is that sometimes we have perfectly legal application of compounds that are being applied to multiple areas simultaneously. Hmm. Think about a beekeeper that is snug across three different farmings, cropping systems, or in an area with owned by different landowners. They're addressing the same cropping pests, but they might be spraying different compounds. And so you might have a beekeeper that is, or bees getting exposed to a mixture, either through kind of a tank mix or just multiple applications happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we're starting to find is that with the West Nile virus problems and the mosquito-borne diseases, there's a lot more mosquito abatement that's happening that we don't know when and where is occurring.
Sure.
And so beekeepers have to be a little bit more aware of looking at signs in the hive, because we can't rely on reports and people to call us to let us know that a spray is going to happen. We don't know when the spraying is happening. And right now, all we're doing is addressing the issue after the fact, rather than finding ways to address it as it's happening or preemptively preparing for those.
Well, Judy, I'm personally very glad that you're on the issue. You're clearly very knowledgeable on this topic. I mean, it's a difficult topic to investigate because there's always someone unhappy with you, regardless of what you find. So I really appreciate your work in this field. It's so important for beekeepers and bee health in general for us to understand what's happening at the colony level with potential exposure scenarios.
Yeah, and it's an exciting area. I think that there's ways that we can address this. I just think we have to think outside the box, and maybe with the beekeepers. I mean, the beekeepers are really the boots on the ground force that move everything,
absolutely,
right? So once we empower the beekeepers to identify when exposure is happening and how and what time of the season, then maybe as researchers we can narrow down the testing field. You know, the part of the problem with testing is it's very expensive to test for 200 different compounds. But maybe if we can narrow down the window of when that exposure happened, we can reduce the cost of testing, we can reduce the cost of screening. Beekeepers might feel more encouraged to report, because right now they don't report because nothing results from a bee.
Yeah, nothing happens.
Investigation.
Yeah. Sure.
They get a pesticide result, but their bees are dead.
Yeah.
And they can't really infer anything from that exposure.
So Judy, I really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So listeners, I just want to thank, you know, publicly Dr. Judy Wu Smart. Judy is an assistant professor and extension specialist in the Department of Entomology. She is the director of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Bee Lab, where she has been for 4 years and is continuing some great work on pesticides. Thank you so much, Judy, for joining us on Two Bees in a Podcast.
Absolutely.
Can we have you back again in the future?
Absolutely. I'd love to.
Well, we're looking forward to it. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
For more information about this podcast, check out our website at www.ufhoneybee.com.
Hey, listeners, we are back, and we just heard Dr. Judy Wu Smart from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln talk about pesticides and some of the pesticide risks. I know she had kind of mentioned pesticide risks a couple of times, and so I just wanted to ask Jamie a couple of questions so you all could hear about pesticides and pesticide risk and what that actually means. So with your toxicology work, Jamie, do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what that actually means? Because I definitely don't understand what that is.
Sure. I mean, you know, and it just, I'm going to put this out there before we even get started. There's no question that this is kind of a controversial subject. Mm-hmm. And maybe by the time I kind of address risk, I will talk more about the controversy and the issues with being a researcher who studies pesticides. But
how many followers are we going to lose?
Well, we'll lose followers. We're going to get some hate posts. It's just inevitable.
Don't hate us.
When we talk about pesticides, but it's hard because this is such an emotional issue, but let's save that until after we talk about something that's a little less emotional.
Okay.
Yeah. So Dr. Wussmark mentioned multiple times risks. She mentioned right toxicity of pesticides to be. She mentioned sublethal effects. So toxicity, there's really two levels of toxicity that you can think about. There's acute toxicity and chronic, mm-hmm. right? And acute means you get exposed to a level that produces a near instant impact, okay. right? In the most acute sense, when you get exposed to a high level, you just die.
Got it.
Or you get exposed to a level and there's instantly a behavioral change. It's acute just simply means there's a high enough residue or exposure that you instantly show signs okay. of intoxication.
So it doesn't mean you're getting it in small doses.
Yeah, exactly. Well, unless a small dose is acutely toxic. Sure. There are some compounds that are highly toxic, so a small dose will produce a very quick acute response. Mm-hmm. Now, chronic means that you're getting exposed to lower doses, these sublethal doses, doses that don't boom, kill you, or boom, change your behavior, but these little exposures might change you know, the gut bacteria in your stomach or behaviors. And chronic is really what Judy was talking about a lot. You heard her say, you know, we don't just need to look at, you know, the toxic response. By mm-hmm. that, she meant acute response. But we also need to consider these sublethal impacts. By that, she meant chronic exposure. Now, here's the simple truth. When you take a toxicology course, all toxicologists say that everything is toxic if you get exposed to enough of it.
Sure.
Right? So toxicity is all about dose, right? Dose and exposure. And so when Judy mentions risk, that is really the key to understanding potential impacts of pesticides on bees. And this is super controversial, but it's super important, I mm-hmm. think, for our listeners mm-hmm. to understand. So risk is simply the product of multiplying toxicity and exposure. So what do I mean by that? So a compound is going to be toxic to honeybees at some level, right? Sure. Let's just pick on neonicotinoids and imidacloprid. There is a level of imidacloprid that if honeybees are exposed to it, they are going to die.
Sure.
All right? And there's a level of imidacloprid that if honeybees are exposed to it, they're not going to die. There might be some sublethal impacts. And then there's a level that's so low that it will neither produce sublethal impacts nor death. All right, so there's this range. As you increase the level of imidacloprid, the toxicity goes up. Mm-hmm. Now, exposure is how much of it or how do bees get exposed. They might get exposed by contacting blooms and mm-hmm. sucking up nectar that has this compound in it. They might get exposed by collecting pollen and bringing it back. They might get exposed by residue levels in the wax or so on. So risk, which is the subject of our discussion now, is toxicity by exposure, right? And so what you're seeing is a lot of bee research done on toxicity. They'll take one really high dose, expose bees to it, it'll kill the bees, they'll announce to the world this compound is toxic, and now all of a sudden we need to ban it. Mm-hmm. But just because a compound is toxic doesn't mean that it poses a high risk. Are you ready for a good analogy, Amy?
I'm ready.
I think this is important. You're laughing behind the scenes because you're like, I love good analogies, right?
Yep.
All right.
Let's see. Yeah, see what you got.
No, I had a former postdoc who explained risk perfectly. All right? You ready to understand risk in its entirety?
I don't believe in anything being perfect.
It's going
but
to be
I'll...
nearly perfect. So, okay. So remember, risk is toxicity by exposure. So think about it this way. Lions are 100% toxic to humans.
To what?
To us.
Okay.
If a lion elects to kill us and it's and our exposure is such that it can, mm-hmm. we're going to die, right? If it says, I'm going to eat you,
probably,
Jamie,
and I'm in
the cage, it's going to kill me. So the toxicity of a lion is very high.
Okay.
Right? So remember, risk is toxicity times exposure. So the toxicity of a lion is really high. But I want to paint for you three exposure scenarios. Exposure scenario one, you're in the Serengeti and you happen upon a lion, your exposure is high. Mm-hmm. The toxicity is high, the exposure is high, so the risk of that...
You're more likely.
It's high. Now, let's say that same lion is removed from Africa and put into a zoo, a cage, mm-hmm. where there are bars on the cage.
Okay.
So the toxicity has not changed. That lion is still very toxic to me. But the risk has changed because the exposure has changed. You know, unless I put my arm into the cage or stick my head in the cage, the exposure's moderate,
Yeah.
Right? Because it's bars, I can still be exposed, but it's moderate. So therefore, the risk is moderate. Toxicity didn't change, but the exposure did. Now, in the third scenario, the toxicity is still the same. If a lion wants to kill me, it can. But if I'm at a zoo and that lion is behind a glass so that I have no exposure to it, the toxicity doesn't change, but the exposure is incredibly low, so the risk to me is low. So what made it a high risk or a moderate risk or a low risk was not how toxic it was to me, but the exposure I experienced with it. And that's honeybee toxicology research in a nutshell. Everyone is doing toxicity work. Very few people are doing exposure work. So as a result, we're making pronouncements that these compounds are highly toxic to bees. Everyone goes crazy about it. We want to ban them, et cetera, et cetera, when the risk can still be low.
Sure.
So the EPA, for example, has developed a risk assessment model, a tool that helps us understand the risk of any particular pesticide to honeybees. And it's called BEREX, B-E-E-R-E-X. And it's an Excel file that you can download. You can do toxicity work. You can plug in your data into this model, and it will say, you know, given the exposure scenarios with the toxicity of this compound, you have a high risk, a moderate risk, or a low risk. And I'm not telling you this to suggest that all compounds are completely innocuous to honeybees. What I'm telling you is when you hear about toxicity, you're only hearing about part of the equation. So when Judy mentions risk, that's essential to understand, because something can be highly toxic to bees but still be a low risk to them. And vice versa, something can have a low toxicity to bees, but the exposure is incredibly high, therefore the risk is high. Do you kind of understand?
Yeah, that makes sense. I don't know if I agree with the lion thing,
though. No, it's perfect. It's perfect. Well, let me tell you, my wife and I lived in South Africa, and we walked upon a lion when we were out in the bush doing research one day. It was about 5 yards from us, and that lion elected not to kill us. I think it was wise, because I was faster than the people I was with. But that lion elected not to kill us, and I'm here to give that lion analogy. But had that lion want to go after me, I was dead. The exposure was quite high. The toxicity was quite high. And even still, I didn't get charged. So.
All right. Well, can I ask you something then? I guess an argument might be that, you know, you were aware that that was, you were around a toxic chemical, right? Or you were exposed, or you were exposing yourself. Could someone argue that honeybees don't necessarily know what they're being exposed to?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But that's we through our research can determine what the level of exposure is through those exposure scenarios. So yes, maybe honeybees aren't aware that they're visiting a flower that has high neonics present in the nectar. But that's stuff that we can do through research. We can create those exposure data. And by create, for those of you conspiracy theorists out there, I'm not saying fabricate. I'm saying we can do experiments to generate those exposure data to go along with our toxicity data so that we are more informed with our understanding of risk. And so the reason this is controversial is because obviously there are pesticide haters and there are pesticide lovers and there's people in between who are trying to wrap their mind around. I mean, if you do research with honeybees and pesticides, you are going to be the target of a hit piece. I mean, my colleagues have been targets of hit pieces. I've been targets of hit pieces. And by that, I mean people who are pretty convinced that you're in the pocket of the pesticide companies and you're doing research to find what they want. Likewise, you know, the reverse can be true. You know, I always tell people, but people don't believe me, you know, that the greatest pressure I get with pesticide research often comes from beekeepers and not pesticide companies, which is completely contrary to what the world views. But it's difficult to do research in pesticides in honeybees because of our responsibility to digest the information out there and say, yeah, it's toxic, that is true, but the risk is low, or the risk is moderate, or the risk is high. It's just been a very difficult tightrope to walk for me and my team and for others who have investigated pesticides.
Yeah, I remember going to bee college a couple of years ago. It was in Central Florida, and it was a talk on bees and pesticides. And at the time, I wanted to you know, educate the community more about pesticides. And so I decided to go to your talk. This was before I was working here, obviously. And I just remember the first thing you said was, we're talking about pesticides and we're talking about bees. Insecticides are a type of pesticides. Bees are insects. So yes, insecticides are probably going to kill bees.
Yeah, right? I mean, every year insecticides kill bees. Sure. I am not at all suggesting that they don't. The question is where do they fit in the level of stressors that bees face? If I don't mitigate pesticide exposure, I won't lose my bees all the time. But if I don't mitigate varroa exposure, my bees are going to die. To me, varroa are a big issue. Now, it's funny because one of the recent hit pieces that came out was, you know, pesticide companies are trying to get everybody to say that varroa is the number one killer of honeybees, so that the pesticides, that's just, I just don't have time for, you know, conspiracies like this. The beekeepers are saying varroa are among their principal stressors. This is coming out in beekeeper surveys. So it's just so difficult. So you're going to make someone unhappy. And so I know I can say this, and there are going to be people who listen and believe what I say and people who don't. But, you know, my loyalty is to truth. You know, we generate data. We try to understand those data the best we can. And, and the data speak for themselves. And, you know, I think most of my colleagues around the country believe the same thing about their work. And so we're loyal to truth. And I think it's going to take working together to understand the impacts of pesticides on bees. Stop calling each other names. Stop, you know, believing in all these crazy conspiracy theories, maybe some of which are true. But knowing that we have to work together to understand stressors, and knowing also that pesticides are one of 5, 6, 8, 10 different things in a colony at any given time, right? Pesticides are present in a lot of Florida bee colonies, a lot of Wisconsin bee colonies, but varroa are present in all those colonies, and viruses are present in most of those colonies, and small hive beetles are present in a lot of those colonies, and those colonies are going to experience nutritional stresses at some point in the year. So understanding the interactions between these stressors is really what's going to go a long way in helping us understand what's contributing to bee losses in general.
Awesome. And I just want to make a point that we do not get paid by the pesticide companies or other different manufacturers, because trust me, I think maybe if I did, I'd probably get paid a lot more.
Well, you know, Amy, I'm going to say, you know what the common critique is when people make the claim that you claim, which is true, I personally don't drive a Bentley, is that, you know, well, they fund research. And we have been funded, some of our research here at the lab has been funded. And that statement right there is going to get us a lot of heat. But we've also been funded by beekeepers.
Yep.
And we've also been funded by the federal government. And we've also been funded by nonprofits. And we've also been funded by small business and big business. So the funny thing is to me is that the world feels that only pesticide companies are capable or want to buy you off. It's not possible for beekeepers to want to buy you off. It's not possible for beekeeper associations. It's not possible for business or industry or government. It's only pesticide companies who are interested in what they want to fund. And it's all hogwash. I mean, many of these arguments that people pose are self-defeating. We've been funded by lots of people. You know, it takes money to do research. And if you're angry about that, then fund some research. Right? You know, fund some research. You know, there's structures in place at universities to minimize the impact that a funding agency can have on the research. That we have to enter contracts with pesticides. We have to enter contracts with beekeeping organizations that want to fund research. So there are safeguards in place. Does that mean humans are not capable of being swayed one way or the other? No, it doesn't mean that. But it does mean that there's a lot of safeguards in place. And I will say that the finger that you point and use to accuse pesticide companies because they are funding research is the same finger that well, by extension, you'd have to point at all funders. And, you know, we can't do research without funding.
I remember at the American Beekeeping Federation, the conference that was in this past January 2020, there was a speaker there, and he basically said, you know, the reason why there's so many stakeholders that contribute to funding is there were a couple hundred people there, you know, at the talk. And he said, if every single person in this room pulled all their money together, it still wouldn't be enough to fund the research that, you know, is being done. And I thought that was a really great point, actually. I mean, it just takes so many people and so many resources, so many people
from
that come
so
to the table.
Many avenues. And that's the thing. That, you know, like I said, I'll make this point again. We've received lots of funding from beekeepers. So So by the very criteria that they use to bash pesticide companies that they themselves are guilty of, right?
Yep.
So it takes part. We have got to collaborate to address this issue. It cannot be done through name calling or shouting. We have to come together. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons that pesticide work is so controversial. And it you know, when someone has convinced themselves that a product is killing bees, and your research, in the limited fashion it is, shows that it's not in this particular scenario, you just instantly become a target. So it's not fun, but it's intellectually rewarding. And like I said, the key is to be loyal to truth.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, that's what I feel, is that my team and I and other teams are loyal to truth. And again, we're going to get hate mail and hate comments, but kind of is what it is. Yeah, so we need to end on a lighter note.
I was about to say, and there we have it. What month is this that we're recording this right
it's
now?
It's February 2020.
All right, so February 2020. So if you all don't hear from us February 2021, it's because you've cut off all of our funding and we are not allowed to share this information.
There you go,
anymore.
Amy. You just contributed to the conspiracy. But with all that said, you know, we value our partnerships with anyone who ethically wants to partner with us and help us find answers to the solutions that are impacting bees today.
Absolutely. We're getting all riled up over here, dropping things left and right. That's all right.
My blood pressure hasn't increased yet, but I'm sure it will in response to this particular podcast.
Don't forget to ask us questions on social media. Make sure that you comment on our posts. Email us. Feel free to email us. We love to have this conversation and continue this conversation.
Yeah. You know, if there's things that you've heard in our podcast today that you won't address in further detail, please leave those comments in social media. That's why we're doing this podcast. We want to go after the difficult topics and address the concerns and comments, queries, conundrums, and quandaries
that
our beekeepers have.
It is that question and answer time, one of our favorite segments.
It's your favorite segment.
Jamie.
I just get stumped.
I have a surprise for you.
Did you get me candy corn or gummy bears
hold on, tamales,
my favorite candies? What is that?
It's to calm our nerves, to get ready for the podcast. What do you think?
Well, you know, the Q&A is at the end of the podcast.
Oh, dang it.
it's a little too late. Or so it's to set the mood for Q&A.
All right. Whatever. I guess we can stop the music.
No, I'll see if it helps my answers get better.
It might. Okay, so we have actually had a lot of questions from the audience. Well, we're just going to go ahead and keep this music on, aren't we? Great.
Does that mean a lot of people are listening to our podcast? Or
I would say so. Yeah. I mean, we've had almost 5,000 listens
from
all over the world. And I've started getting voicemails on my telephone.
I need to email my mom and tell her thank you for listening so many times.
That's fair. All right. So we do have a lot of questions from the audience, and we are going to try to acknowledge as many of them as we can. The first question I have for you, Jamie, is there anything interesting about the bee's knees?
There's six of them. Yeah. Actually, they have multiple joints in their legs, so probably each leg has at least two
all right,
knees.
All
so
right.
That would be at least 12 knees on the bees.
I bet dance class is really hard for them. All right, that's not
they
actually.
They don't just have one left foot.
That actually was a question.
They have
from
three
someone.
Left feet.
Well, we can.
So dance is probably hard for them.
we can talk about the waggle dance again another time.
All right, let's do the serious.
So let's be serious.
Now.
Okay, so. One.
How could I be serious with that? All right, we're ready.
Okay, so, you know, do commercial beekeepers do preventative treatments for American foul brood? And should backyard beekeepers also be doing preventatives?
So to answer the first question first, the answer is yes and no. Some commercial beekeepers do preventative treatment, so that's prophylactic, right? They're treating their bees in advance of having a problem. Then they're doing that with antibiotics, and they may do it multiple times per year. A good question is that the best strategy? And really, that kind of goes into the second question, should backyard beekeepers do it? So what's the best strategy? The best strategy was really discussed by Dr. Megan Milbreath, who joined us on a past podcast. She's from Michigan State University, and she says rather than doing prophylactic treatment for American foul brood, you should do metaphylactic treatment. So you're not treating in advance of having a problem. What you're doing is you're managing your bees, and when a colony becomes positive for American foul brood in your apiary, if that happens, you destroy that colony, you burn it. Then you treat the remaining colonies with an antibiotic, a labeled antibiotic. So rather than blanket treatment every apiary, mm-hmm. every year, mm-hmm. you're killing the colony you find that has it, and then you're treating the rest of them. That's similar to what you would do, you know, maybe in livestock. If there's a cow that has a really bad disease, you cull it, and then you treat the rest of the herd. And so that's what I would recommend. I think that's a good strategy, metaphylactic treatment for good. American fowl brood.
Yeah, so backyard beekeepers, and all beekeepers should really
I think it's a good strategy. Yeah. A lot of people would argue with me and want to have that prophylactic treatment, but really, if you're prophylactically treating, you could have American fowl brood, but you just won't see it because you're keeping it down, and as a result you could be spreading it around, and failure to treat then could cause it to pop up. So I think treating the rest of the apiary in response to finding it in one colony that you eradicate is a more responsible and appropriate response.
That's fair. We'll play that Mortal Kombat music when people want to fight with you. All right, so for the second question,
that was it. I was a kid, and Mortal Kombat was popular when I was a kid. Quit laughing. I used to be a kid, Amy.
That's great. Okay, so for the second question, someone is asking about heat treatments. So heat treatments for mites. Does this work, and what do you recommend?
Okay, so I would argue that the jury is still out. I think it's a little early to be making comments about heat treatment from an academic perspective. I know a lot of people are excited about this. There's a lot of instruments that you can put on colonies that are out there. A lot of beekeepers tell me that heat treatment works for them. I just haven't seen enough data. The moment the data are available, I'll be the first one to believe it once that data set's robust. But I still think the jury's out. I think that there's people studying this, and it's kind of exciting. And for those of you listeners who are not even sure why we're talking about this, there's some indication, maybe anecdotal, that heating colonies will cause varroa to die in lower varroa populations. And so there's all these contraptions out now that you can purchase and put on colonies to raise the temperature. But I still think we need a lot to know about these things. So that's just kind of where I am. I don't. If you've got some money and want to tinker around with it, I think that's okay. But I'm kind of stopping short of a wholesale requirement or recommendation of the use of these things.
Yeah, and on that comment, actually, the person said that they had 10 hives in one yard, and they could only do one or two a day, and that's assuming they can make it there every day. And that, I don't know if that seems very practical as far as people with thousands.
That's the thing, is it's just like so many other things. A lot of these cool ideas that pop out, if they work, they're really only relevant to backyard beekeepers. It's going to be very difficult for commercial beekeepers to implement that. You're right. It's one of these things you put on a colony, and they're usually expensive, $400 or $500. Mm-hmm. You put them on a colony, and then you have to switch them, and then you've got to have a power source, and you know, it just gets complicated fast. But if it works, if it turns out to work, it's going to be worth doing. We just need to know more about it.
I can imagine a really, really long extension cord. All right.
For shizzle.
Okay, so for our last question for the Q&A, what methods do you recommend? I feel like I need to speak like differently because of the music.
I feel like we're talking in an elevator. Hurry up, push the first floor.
All right. What methods? I'm going to push every button. That's the type of person I am.
I feel like you have already, Amy.
So what methods do you recommend the most to prevent and or recover from heavy losses such as winter losses?
Well, prevention is going to be very difficult because there's, you know, a lot of things to talk about there. But what I would argue is you got to keep your varroa under control, and you've got to make sure they have enough nutrition well in advance of heading into winter. You know, you can't just control varroa in June and expect, you know, your bees to be okay heading into winter in October or November. So I think you've got to have varroa manage adequate nutrition in the colonies, especially in the form of honey. They've got to have a lot of nectar mm-hmm. resources available to them in their hive, or honey resources available in their hive, so they can survive winter. Really, I think the question's about what do you do if you've experienced high losses. And what I would recommend is I would very quickly try to understand what those losses were caused by, you know, what caused those losses, because you're going to need to remedy that in the colonies that actually survived. If you're coming out of winter with weak colonies, you need to check varroa populations, you need to check Nosema levels, potentially you need to look at their food resources, and you need to address them quickly. If you have colonies that survive, and even beekeepers who have high colony losses, if they have colonies survive, and they usually do, they invest heavily in growing those colonies that are then splittable and can help you recover your losses. The entire commercial industry really is built on splitting colonies to recover losses that from bees that are coming out of winter.
So would you say that people should assume that they're going to be losing those colonies and split before?
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that if you keep any number of colonies, you're going to lose some through winter. And now your losses may be as low as 5%, or they could be as high as 50% or greater. And so really a lot of commercial beekeepers understand what their average losses are. So they try to overcompensate for that by having colonies strong, a lot of them heading into winter, so that if they experience what they call, you know, typical losses, they will mm-hmm. still have a critical mass coming out that they can split again to recover those losses.
Awesome. All right. Well, we're trying to acknowledge everyone's questions. There are just so many coming in, so we're just taking a couple at a time, and we have questions for the rest of our life to answer.
Hey, I'm glad that indicates that, you know, people are listening to this podcast. We want you to ask your questions, and ones that we feel like we can't answer, we will do our best to answer. So thank you so much for submitting them on social media.
We'd like to give an extra special thank you to the following: to our editors, Shelby Howell and Bailey Carroll, and to our audio engineer, James Weaver. Without their hard work, Two Bees in a Podcast would not be possible. So thank you.
For more information and additional resources for today's episode, don't forget to visit the UF Ivis Honeybee Research and Extension Laboratory's website, ufhoneybee.com. Do you have questions you want answered on air? If so, email them to honeybee@ifas.ufl.edu or message us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at UF Honeybee Lab. While there, don't forget to follow us. Thank you for listening to Two Bees in a Podcast.